This episode is brought to you by Sterling Soap Company. Fellas, you've heard the phrase, look good, feel good, right? But why not add smell good to that too? That's where Sterling Soap Company comes in. First, Sterling Soap is 100% natural and has a wide variety of bath soaps, shave soaps, beard balm, lotions, and cologne. Second, there's a scent just for you. How about burgundy? Yeah, it's more than a color. The Sterling Soap folks blend natural essential oils with hints of mahogany, golden amber, and sandalwood. Or how about D503, an intensely masculine scent inspired by Legend by Mont Blanc. And third, you will feel good about the price. For just a little more than you'd pay at the grocery store, Sterling Soap will leave you feeling clean, refreshed, and ready for whatever's next. Give Sterling Soap a try today. Visit sterlingsoap.com. This Day in Sports History. Hey, and welcome to another edition of This Day in Sports History. It's May 6th, and this is one of those days when the world changed, when what had previously been thought impossible became possible. Because on this day in 1954, Roger Bannister became the first human to run a mile in under 4 minutes. Roger Bannister woke up that morning to a slate gray sky outside his window, and he could see the tops of the trees being buffeted by the wind. He had hoped for good weather for his race later that evening as part of the meet at Iffley Road, but by the looks of it, the weather was not going to cooperate. 4 months of intense preparation had led to this point, this race. If rain muddied the cinder track, if he ran into a headwind on the backstretch, it could be enough to prevent him from achieving his goal. Putting off the attempt until the next available opportunity on May 17th was an option, but not a very good one. It would mean another 11 days of intense pressure, the constant anxiety, and then wondering if one of the other two men attempting to do the same thing would get there before him. And to say he had only been pursuing this goal for 4 months would be incorrect. Bannister had been serious in his pursuit shortly after a disappointing 1500-meter race in the 1952 Olympics, and had set his sight on doing what many believed to be the impossible. He had run a 4:03.6 in May 1953, and then made another attempt the following month and set a new British record of 4 minutes 2 seconds with the assistance of pacing runners in a one-off event. But that record was disallowed by British officials because it had not been conducted during a regularly scheduled meet and it was considered unsporting. Bannister was criticized for a selfish pursuit of the record outside the realm of track and field events. So, Bannister had reason to be anxious. Two other men were in pursuit of the same thing, and they were all aware of each other. There was Australia's John Landy, who on January 21, 1954, made an attempt at the record on a beautiful summer evening in Melbourne. Running the race against a field of runners who were not allowed to pace him, he ran the mile in 4 minutes 2.4 seconds. A huge throng of people there to hopefully witness history were cheering so loudly that Landy could not hear the lap times as he came by, and he had nothing to let him know how he was doing except for his body and his own internal clock. And then there was American Wes Santee, the Ashland Antelope, a collegiate runner at Kansas, who, if it had not been for some poor weather or a college coach who would not let him make a run for the record just once without having to compete in several other events, or a stodgy AAU punishing him for accepting a travel allowance, he actually might have accomplished the feat before Bannister. On December 31, 1953, Santee had run in an exhibition at the Sugar Bowl in New Orleans, ripping off a time of 4 minutes 4.2 seconds in wet, boggy conditions. His last lap was an insane 55-second loop. And on April 17, 1954, Santee, the Kansas Flyer, made another attempt, knowing that Bannister's race for sub-4 was coming up in early May. A brief but fierce downpour of rain minutes before that race started once again made the condition soggy. This time he ran a 58.6 final lap, but he hit the tape in 4 minutes 3.1 seconds. So Bannister could hear the footsteps, and his attempt had to be made today, or it just might not happen. Oh, and Bannister was also a full-time medical student. He spent the day at the hospital doing his regular duties, though he did manage to escape to the lab to sharpen his running spikes on his specially made 4-ounce shoes and then rub them with a little graphite so the cinder ash wouldn't clump on his shoes during the race. In the late afternoon, Bannister and his two teammates who would help pace him, Chris Chataway and Chris Brasher, headed to Iffley Road. The race was scheduled for 6 p.m. As late as 5:44 that night, the dark clouds were looming. A stiff breeze was blowing. All three had to decide to go or no go. At exactly 5:45, the clouds parted, a rainbow appeared, and the wind died down. It was a yes from all three, and they lined up for event number 9 of the evening, with their other AAA teammate along with two Oxford runners running in this race. The crowd of about 1,200 went silent, waiting for the gun. Brasher jumped, a crucial false start that got him a warning from the starter and was a little perturbing for Bannister since the wind could kick up at any point. They lined up again and waited. Bannister knew this was his moment, his last chance, really. He believed he could and would do it. And then the gun fired, and Rogers settled in behind his pacemaker, Brasher. They turned the first lap in 57.5 seconds. Chataway was running right behind him. They crossed the 2-mile mark in 1 minute 58 seconds. Brasher first, then Bannister, then Chataway. At the 2.5-mile mark, Brasher was toast, and he moved right to let Bannister come past. Roger yelled to Chataway to assume the pace, and despite being fatigued, he jumped out in front. Chataway and Bannister crossed the line at mile 3 at 3:04. He needed to run the final quarter in 59 seconds, or it would be all for nothing. Chataway stayed out front until he blew up on the backstretch, and then Bannister surged around the outside, and he now knew he was all alone. With half a lap to go, he had 30 seconds to get to the finish line. With 50 yards to go, he was spent, but he kept on going. Head back, arms working, he pushed himself through the tape. Stopwatches clicked. 3:59.4. He had done it. What at one time had been said to be humanly impossible, Roger Bannister had run the first human sub-4-minute mile. Hours later, Santee got the news from local reporters, anxious for a quote. And when asked why he was beaten to the punch, Santee responded, "Having to compete for the university, I've had to run everything from soup to nuts. I haven't been permitted to concentrate on it." Landy was in Finland, making preparations for a mile race that had been his planned assault on the 4-minute mile. When he heard, he went from surprise to disbelief to disappointment, and now knowing the pressure to be the first had been released, well, there was a little bit of relief too. On June 21st, Landy bested Bannister's time with a time of 3:57.9. But then again, nobody really remembers Landy, or Santee, who through a series of continuing unfortunate events, never ran a sub-4-minute mile. I don't think I'm wrong when I say that when we think back upon major moments in sports or even human history, that we tend to think about these things happening in a vacuum, so not affected by outside forces or information. Roger Bannister, Englishman, ran really fast that day and became the first sub-4 runner on the planet. But again, it didn't happen in a vacuum. There was so much going on that influenced what Bannister accomplished on this day. And that's why I wanted to spend so much time on it. And I should also say that for this story, I used Neil Bascom's book, The Perfect Mile, as a reference. Bascom's book is excellent and really delves into the history of the pursuit of the 4-minute mile and what happened on this day in 1954. Okay. All right, whew, that was a lot of stuff there. But there are other things that happened on this day as well throughout history. You know, back in 1925, New York Yankee Everett Scott was benched by manager Miller Huggins. Now, you may be asking, who is Everett Scott? Well, before Lou Gehrig, Scott was the leader in consecutive games played. He was in a hitting slump, and the Yankees were 5-11 here in the early part of the 25 season, and so Huggins pulled him from the lineup after playing in 1,307 consecutive games. Interestingly, though, Gehrig's consecutive game streak started less than a month later, on June 1st. And do you know Bobo Holloman? Well, on this day in 1953, Bobo became the first pitcher to throw a no-hitter in his major league debut. Holloman was pitching for the St. Louis Browns against the Philadelphia A's in front of a pretty sparse crowd of 2,500 at Sportsman's Park. He pitched a solid 8 innings, and then he had a shaky ninth, walking a couple of batters before getting a double play ball and then a flyout to preserve his no-hitter. Bobo also helped himself out with 3 hits at the plate that day, as the Browns won 6-0, and Bobo became the first Brown to throw a no-hitter in 36 years, and again, the first ever in the league to do it in his first career start. And in 1998, 20-year-old Kerry Wood became just the second pitcher in Major League Baseball history to strike out 20 batters in a 9-inning game in a 2-0 win over Houston. It was just the 5th career start for Wood, and this game was nearly a no-hitter. He faced 29 batters, giving up just one hit, which many there that day say should have been ruled an error. He hit a batter later on, he struck out 20, and he did not give up a walk. Now, at that point, only Roger Clemens had struck out 20 in a 9-inning game, doing it twice, actually, in 1986 and then again in 1996. Max Scherzer joined the list and is the last to do it in 2016 when he pitched for the Washington Nationals. And time now for today's non-sports Did You Know? Well, this kind of blurs that line a little bit, but a race car traveling in excess of 200 miles per hour would be able to cover the length of a football field in less than a second. That's all for today. And you know what else is fast? Leaving a 5-star review and a comment on Apple Podcasts. It's quick, it's easy, and you will feel so good about yourself once you do it. And I would greatly appreciate it. Anyway, have a great rest of your day, and I'll see you tomorrow for another This Day in Sports History. This has been an original Thrive Suite production.
Hey there, Sports History fans. We've got some exciting news to share with you. 6 of our podcasts from the Sports History Network have made it to the final round of voting for the prestigious Sports Podcast Awards. Here are their shows and the categories. Historically Speaking Sports and This Day in Sports History are both competing for Best Sports Talk Podcast. No Nonsense Old School Weightlifting History is in the running for Best Fitness, Health, and Well-Being Podcast. When Football Was Football is up for Best Sports Documentary Podcast. Wrestling with Heels On has entered the ring for Best Wrestling Podcast. And Shoulder Roll Virtual Boxing is fighting for the title for Best Combat Sports Podcast. Now, of course, we need your help to take home the championship for each of these awesome shows. All you gotta do is head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/vote, cast your vote for your favorite shows, or better yet, all 6 of them. Again, every vote counts, and we gotta show the world how much sports history really matters. So thank you for your support and making Sports History Network the headquarters for sports yesteryear. But again, don't wait. You got to go vote now. That's over at sportshistorynetwork.com/vote.